KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Senator Chris Van Hollen meets the man illegally deported to El Salvador as an appeals court says the administration is asserting a right to stash people in foreign prisons without due process. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Europe is cutting interest rates, and President Trump is pressuring the Federal Reserve to do the same thing here. I'm Leila Falde.
And I'm Martinez. Fed Chair Jerome Powell says he can't be fired. What protects him from political pressure? Also, the Trump administration stops a multi-billion dollar wind project that was already underway, and Cheech and Chong on what could be their last movie together. It's Friday, April 18th, the publication date in 1938 of Action Comics number one, the debut of a certain alien refugee destined to be Superman. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the U.S. could, quote, move on if a peace deal is not reached soon between Ukraine and Russia. Rubio is in Paris for talks about the war. It's not clear if he means dropping U.S. efforts to get a truce or if the U.S. would walk away from commitments to Ukraine. A federal judge has again blocked DOGE staffers operating inside the Social Security Administration from accessing sensitive personal information. NPR's Stephen Fowler reports the data is on millions of Americans.
U.S. District Judge Ellen Lipton Hollander wrote late Thursday that the legal issue isn't with the work that DOGE wants to do inside the Social Security Administration, but rather how they want to do the work. Last month, Hollander issued a temporary restraining order blocking DOGE staffers from sensitive Social Security databases because they couldn't explain why they needed unfettered access to personally identifiable information. In granting the preliminary injunction, the judge said that's a question the Trump administration still can't answer. Stephen Fowler, NPR News.
Authorities in Tallahassee, Florida have arrested a suspect in yesterday's deadly mass shooting at Florida State University. Two people were killed and six others wounded. The suspect is a student and the son of a sheriff's deputy. Officials allege his mother's former service weapon was used in the attack. NPR's Greg Allen says the incident began around noon, Eastern time.
A campus-wide alert went out that an active shooter was reported near the Student Union building. Police responded quickly and began evacuating students. It set the whole campus into lockdown. By 3 p.m. yesterday, law enforcement said the campus had been secured and the threat was over. Police say the shooter didn't surrender when they confronted him, and he was shot and wounded.
NPR's Greg Allen reporting. The National Weather Service says critical fire weather conditions persist in the Southwest today, especially New Mexico. Windy and dry conditions could help fuel wildfires there. Hamas says that Israel's latest proposal for a temporary ceasefire does not meet its criteria for permanently ending the war. Meanwhile, families of Israeli hostages are demanding that the Israeli government agree to a deal that frees them all in one phase, even at the cost of ending the war. NPR's Aya Batrawi reports.
Israel's ceasefire offer would have released half the living hostages still held in Gaza and eased a weeks-long blockade on the territory where aid groups say food is running out. Crucially, it would have also halted for 6 weeks Israeli airstrikes and ground offensives that Gaza's health ministry says have killed around 1,700 people since the last ceasefire ended a month ago. Israel's proposal, however, had a new explicit demand that Gaza be disarmed, with Hamas giving up its weapons. The group's chief negotiator, Khalil al-Hayya, said in public remarks, Hamas is prepared to release all Israeli hostages for a complete end to the war and Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. But he said resistance is a, quote, natural right of all people under occupation, and said weapons are linked to that.
This is NPR. The State Department releases annual reports on the state of human rights in other countries. NPR has reviewed internal State Department documents that show the Trump administration will no longer track more than 20 categories of human rights abuses in these reports. It won't check for violations of privacy rights or whether there's been violence against minorities or people with disabilities. And it won't track whether other countries are observing their citizens' right to free and fair elections. China's foreign ministry has rejected as, quote, groundless Ukrainian President Zelensky's accusation that Beijing has supplied weapons to Russia. NPR's Awen Tsao has more.
The statement came a day after President Zelensky alleged at a press conference that China was sending weapons and gunpowder to Russia, and even producing weapons on Russian territory. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Lin Jian responded at a regular news briefing, saying China has never provided lethal weapons to any party involved in the Ukraine conflict. He said, quote, China's position on the Ukraine issue has always been clear, and quote, we've been actively working to promote a ceasefire and push for peace talks. Lin added that China opposes what he called groundless accusations and political manipulation, pointing out that Ukraine itself has said most components in Russian weapons come from the United States and other Western nations. Alwyn Tao, NPR News, Beijing.
This year's NBA Finals open tomorrow. The top seed in the NBA's Western Conference is the Oklahoma City Thunder. The top seed in the Eastern Conference is the Cleveland Cavaliers. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And Amy Martinez in Culver City, California. Coming up, we'll speak with a financial historian about how President Trump may be threatening the independence of the Federal Reserve.
First, though, Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen held a face-to-face meeting with Kilmer Abrego Garcia yesterday.
He's the Salvadoran citizen who lived in Maryland for about 15 years before the administration illegally deported him last month. Now he's being held in a notorious mega prison in El Salvador, where the administration is sending people deported from the U.S. Now the White House insists he will not be returning to the U.S. despite a federal judge's order to facilitate his return.
Joining us with the latest is NPR's Ryland Barton. Good morning, Ryland.
Hi, Leila.
Okay, so Senator Van Hollen says Salvadoran officials initially refused to let him meet with Abrego Garcia, and then we see a meeting happened. What changed?
Yeah, so we know very little about how exactly the meeting happened, but in an interview yesterday on All Things Considered, Van Hollen said soldiers had initially prevented him from reaching the prison.
I was stopped by soldiers about 3 kilometers out, who said they'd been ordered not to allow me to go see him. My mission today was simply to see how his health is, what his condition is.
So later in the day, the president of El Salvador, Nayib Bukele, tweeted that Van Hollen had met with Abrego Garcia and said that since Abrego Garcia had been confirmed healthy, he gets the honor of staying in El Salvador's custody. The senator then tweeted out a picture of the two of them sitting at a table and said he had called Abrego Garcia's wife to pass along a message of love. In a statement, White House spokesman Kush Desai said the meeting showed Democrats were prioritizing the welfare of what he called an illegal alien MS-13 terrorist. The Trump administration has repeatedly said Abrego Garcia is a member of MS-13, which is a transnational gang. But Abrego Garcia's lawyers dispute that, pointing to the fact that he doesn't even have a criminal record in the U.S. U.S.
Now, there was yet another court ruling against the Trump administration's handling of Abrego Garcia yesterday. What did it say?
Yeah, so the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals tore into the administration, saying they are, quote, asserting a right to stash away residents of this country in foreign prisons without the semblance of due process. Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson, who was appointed by President Reagan, headed up that three-judge panel. He noted that the Justice Department had already admitted it deported Abrego Garcia mistakenly and asked, quote, why then should it not make what was wrong right? Earlier this week, a judge had ruled Abrego Garcia's lawyers should be able to question administration officials, but the Department of Justice argues that that was untenable and said the government had no powers to return Abrego Garcia. But with this latest ruling, they have lost that argument, so now officials must explain what they're doing, if anything, to bring him back, or they could appeal again, this time to the Supreme Court.
And what did the court say about the administration's refusal to comply with these orders?
Yeah, so Judge Wilkinson said this is a slippery slope. In his order, he imagined a future in which there would be no assurances that the executive branch would not deport American citizens or train its powers on political enemies. He said we're in a moment where the executive and judicial branches are close to grinding irrevocably against one another in a conflict that promises to diminish both. But he also said there is an opportunity here, saying, quote, we yet cling to the hope that it is not naive to believe our good brethren in the executive branch perceive the rule of law as vital to the American ethos. This ruling follows a decision from U.S. District Judge James Boasberg earlier this week, where he said he might hold Trump officials in contempt for disregarding his order to stop sending deportees to that same Salvadoran prison.
That's NPR's Ryland Barton. Thank you, Ryland.
Thank you.
President Trump is trying to pressure the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates, which it's reluctant to do because of tariffs. And after Fed Chair Jerome Powell warned that Trump's tariff policies could make it harder to limit inflation, the president posted on social media yesterday that Powell's termination, quote, cannot come fast enough. To talk this through, we're joined by Peter Conti Brown. He's a financial historian and associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Peter, welcome to the program. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So does the president have the legal authority to fire Powell before his term expires in May of next year?
You know, last time we had almost exactly this conversation, the first Trump administration, the answer was much clearer that the president did not. But in the last few months in the second Trump administration, the president has made an assault on the independence of administrative agencies a keystone of his legal strategy. And those very questions, which are currently being litigated, could determine the answer to that question. It's much more uncertain today than it was in, say, 2018.
What makes it more uncertain? I mean, Trump has fired, as you point out, members of independent agencies since taking office, and the Supreme Court sided with him in a case related to two of those firings earlier this month. Is that what is making this moment uncertain?
That's the big part of it. The Supreme Court and the Trump administration itself have said, kind of hinted, that the Fed might be different. But as I sit here today as both a historian and as a legal scholar, I read the statutes and they have exactly, nearly word for word, the same protections at the Federal Trade Commission, for example, as the Federal Reserve. So if those protections go away because the Supreme Court writes them away, then the independence of the Federal Reserve is much more fragile than it was before.
Why is the Fed's independence important? And is Trump's attempt to pressure it its actions unique to a president?
The independence of the Federal Reserve stands for the idea that all politicians are going to want to goose the economy in the short term because that makes their voters and their constituents happy. And that's a bipartisan enthusiasm. In that sense, President Trump is not unique. Nearly every president has wanted the Fed to be more accommodating to their policies. But we don't want a short-term sugar rush of stimulus in the economy. And so Congress designed the central bank to have its eye on the long-term ball. We want stability. We want growth without inflation. And so the independence of the Federal Reserve is to create that kind of scenario. What's unique about President Trump is his wide assertions to delegitimize that very independence. And that's the thing, as I say here today, that I fear the most.
You say you fear that. What happens if it comes to fruition?
If people don't trust the Federal Reserve to keep their eye on that long-term ball, if they believe President Trump that it's just political hacks operating monetary policy and doing so incompetently, then their ability to plan, to trust in these institutions, to put their confidence in the economy for the future will upend everything about that we understand about economic growth and about where we're going as an economy.
Yesterday, Politico reported that Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has warned the White House that firing Powell could destabilize financial markets. Is he correct?
He's absolutely right. The destabilization we've seen in the bond markets, for example, in reaction to the tariff policy, would be like a child's soccer game compared to the World Cup of destabilization if we lose Fed independence. Fed independence is the bulwark of stability for the bond market, for our capital markets, for the U.S. dollar. If that goes away, well, we know this story. We've seen economies like this in Turkey and Lebanon and Venezuela and so many other places. The Fed's independence keeps us from that chaos.
I mean, you're describing economies that have failed, that have tanked. I mean, is that possible in the U.S.?
That is not something that I would have said yes to even many months ago, but I would say that it is possible today, yes.
Trump allies argue that the president should have more authority over independent agencies. They exist under the executive branch. What are your thoughts on that argument?
I think the idea of independence is a bit of a red herring. The Federal Reserve is not independent. It's insulated. The president has enormous power to influence the direction of the Fed. And that comes when Jay Powell's term ends 1 year from now and he gets to select the next Fed chair. But it shouldn't come before.
Peter Conti Brown is a financial historian at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the U.S. will walk away from efforts to broker a ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine if progress isn't made within days. Rubio spoke a day after a new peace push in Paris, organized by French President Emmanuel Macron, that for the first time included European allies. Here's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley.
After 2 months of direct talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin went nowhere, the Trump administration seemed willing to give the European initiative a shot, sending its top three diplomats to Paris. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio and White House envoys Steve Witkoff and Keith Kellogg sat down with French President Emmanuel Macron and envoys from the U.K., Germany, and Ukraine. It was the highest level of transatlantic engagement on the conflict since February. Macron said the meeting had been productive and that talks would continue in London next week. But leaving Paris this morning, Rubio said things had to happen in a matter of days, not weeks.
If it's not possible, if we're so far apart that this is not going to happen, then I think the president's probably at a point where he's going to say, well, we're done.
That comes as no surprise to Ukraine expert Nicholas Tenzer, who says Europe has different priorities than those of the White House.
To find a deal with Putin, Russia, and then basically to turn to other matters, namely China, Asia, etc. And then he wants basically to get rid of this issue, even if it means a kind of full surrender to Putin.
He says for the Europeans, the defense of Ukraine and survival of the Ukrainian nation is a priority in itself and key to European security. Tenzer says whatever the U.S. decides, the Europeans will continue to arm and support Ukraine. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about Medgar and Merle Evers. Medgar was a civil rights leader from Mississippi who was assassinated in 1963 because of his work fighting for voting rights and desegregation. His wife Merle became a civil rights activist after his murder. We'll talk with Joy Ann Reed. Her book is Medgar and Merle. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate, at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez.
Who is it?
It's me, Dave. Open up, man. I got the stuff.
In the 1970s, Cheech and Chong were the OGs of pot humor.
Dave?
Yeah, Dave. Come on, man. Open up. I think the cops
are coming. Dave's not here.
No, man. I'm Dave, man.
Their albums hit the top 10. Their live shows sold out. Their movie screenings were jam-packed with fans, though I have no idea how they saw the screen through the haze. There's a new documentary about their partnership. It's called Cheech and Chong's Last Movie. Now, here's one thing I learned. Before he met Cheech, Tommy Chong was in a band signed to Motown Records.
I had a family-owned nightclub in Vancouver, Canada, and the house band. We never had a name, but we had a house band, and we had a great singer named Bobby Taylor. And Diana Ross and the Supremes came and heard Bobby sing. So she phoned Berry Gordy, and Berry Gordy literally flew the next day. He signed us. He loved us, signed us. I got fired from Motown.
They found out he was Chinese.
It was in that nightclub that Tommy Chong first met Cheech Marin in 1969. Cheech grew up in L.A., but went to Vancouver to learn pottery and to avoid getting drafted for the Vietnam War. The two started performing comedy together, then made their way to L.A. to hone their act. As they got bigger, they got to shoot their first film on a shoestring budget. Up in Smoke became a cult smash in 1978.
You know, like I smoked that Michoacan, man, Acapulco Gold, man. I even smoked that tight stick, you know?
Tight stick?
Yeah, you know, that stuff is tied to a stick, you know?
Oh, yeah, tight stick.
So my mom would not let me watch your stuff.
That's a wise mom.
She was afraid. No, she was afraid that I would start smoking pot. But did you ever come up with, like, later on with people's like, I always wanted to see what you did, but I was always not allowed to see what you did.
All the time. We heard that story all the time. And it's always with the fathers that come in, blah, 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 yeah. You can't do this. And they became the biggest fans. It was never the moms. It was always the dads.
Did you guys ever think, like, this association with marijuana, because at the time it's illegal taboo, did you ever think that that eventually might be something that would harm you at some point?
No, we never really thought about it because we were reflecting the culture that was around us at the time. And we did a survey of all the material we did at both on stage and on records. And it was only 5% of anything we did. Hmm. But it was the biggest image that came up in everybody's mind as soon as they first heard about us or saw us.
But even, Cheech, you came to a point where you wanted to do something not related to marijuana, right?
Yeah. Then we were getting pegged, oh, they're just about marijuana and blah, 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 blah.
Well, that was our secret sauce with the studios. And so we got a movie called the Corsican Brothers. Cheech and I decided that no pot in this one. You know, this is our chance.
Because they hadn't invented pot.
They hadn't invented pot.
And so I directed it and wrote it. And the studio, they weren't too happy. The suit that was assigned to the movie, she kept trying to get us to put pot in the movie.
Well, your films, like in the video store, like when they actually had the videotapes, right? It was almost like your films, you know, in the bookstore where you have like the X-rated magazines. Yeah, it's Oh, you always felt like you're kind of looking around to see who's watching you grab Up in Smoke or grab next movie. It almost felt like I had to like grab it and stick it in my coat and walk.
That was like an advertising dream. Hmm. You know, if you got something that's taboo, it's called like negative publicity. Up in Smoke kind of was like starting that. In fact, the advertising line was, don't go straight to this movie.
Cheech and Chong's Up in Smoke. Don't go straight to see this movie.
I was watching the documentary. There was a point in it where, and this is where you guys need to help me, like what's real and what isn't, where it was a little uncomfortable when you guys were talking about the films that you were in and who directed.
On the other movies, I would write. Cheech would go on vacation, Howard would make the deal, and then we'd come in and shoot. But this time, Cheech wanted to be involved in everything. And he didn't want me to direct. Tom Alvison was the editor. I said, okay, Tom, you direct. You'll go down as a director. I don't care. But I'll actually be the director.
So, Tommy, you directed the films.
Wrote
and directed them.
And directed.
Wrote the films.
But you didn't get Cheech the director credit.
I didn't want director credit.
We both directed. See, back in the day, there was rules, unwritten rules. You know, you don't have two directors until the Coen brothers came in, you know. And it's all about the old way of doing the money. You see, because if you're a director, you're getting paid.
So if we were to go back in time to kind of, you know, recredit the films, would it be directed by Cheech and Chong?
Yeah, probably would be.
But, I mean, Cheech, did you ever get annoyed that...
No, not at that point. Just, you know, when I wanted to kind of go in a slightly different direction or do something, and then that's where the division came.
Because in the documentary, it seemed like that was a tense moment between you two.
Well, you always were the director. It wasn't like
you got to earn it. You can't just say, oh, because I was there with the other guy that directed, I should be a director.
See, that's a lie.
That's a lie?
Yeah, well, of course it's a lie. I directed just as much as you did in the movies.
Oh, it is a tense moment.
It's still a tense moment.
Well, we broke up after that. Okay, yeah. you go mine, and that was it. And we were broken up for 20 years.
Yeah.
And then we came back together for another 20 years, it seemed like. We didn't make movies or make records, but we were on the road.
Yeah. Now, you're publicizing the film, Cheech and Chong's last movie. I mean, should we take that literally? Is this the last time we're going to see Cheech and Chong together?
Yeah, you never know. I mean, really, you never know. If something comes up and we like it, you might see a Cheech and Chong's last movie.
Last movie?
Yeah.
That's Cheech Marin and Tommy Chong. They're the subjects of the new documentary, Cheech and Chong's Last Movie. It's receiving a limited release on, of course, you guessed it, 420. Gentlemen, thank you for coming in.
Our pleasure.
Are we on? Come on, let's go get high. Up in smoke. That's where I want to be.
This is NPR News.
A new podcast uses folktales to explore the richness of Sudan's culture and history at a time when the country is mired in a devastating civil war.
When you hear the music, read the literature, taste the food of a people, you come closer to them.
I'm Elsa Chang, Folktales from Sudan on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst.
Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen had a face-to-face meeting with Kilmer Abrego Garcia in El Salvador yesterday. He's the Maryland man illegally deported to El Salvadorian prison. The White House insists he won't be returning to the U.S. despite a federal judge's order to facilitate his return. NPR's Ryland Barton has more.
The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals tore into the administration, saying they are, quote, asserting a right to stash away residents of this country in foreign prisons without the semblance of due process. Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson headed up the three-judge panel. He noted that the Justice Department had already admitted it deported Abrego Garcia mistakenly and asked, quote, why then should it not make what was wrong right?
NPR's Ryland Barton reporting. The Supreme Court is taking up a legal question on President Trump's claim that there's no such thing as birthright citizenship guaranteed in the Constitution. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
The 14th Amendment to the Constitution, enacted after the Civil War, was aimed at overturning the infamous Dred Scott decision, which said basically that enslaved people brought to the United States and their children were not citizens of the United States and therefore essentially had no rights. After the Civil War, Congress passed a constitutional amendment to fix that.
NPR's Nina Totenberg. A decision is expected this summer. You're listening to NPR News. At Florida State University, a vigil is planned on the campus today for victims of a mass shooting yesterday near the student union that left two people dead, six others injured. People are being allowed in the building today to gather belongings left behind in yesterday's chaos. The 20-year-old alleged gunman, son of a local sheriff's deputy, is hospitalized after police shot him. There's no word yet on a motive. Chinese goods may soon become harder to find in the U.S. NPR's John Ruich reports exporters at a massive trade fair in China say shipments to the U.S. are grinding to a halt in response to President Trump's sky-high tariffs.
At the Canton Fair in southern China, tens of thousands of Chinese companies display products, and customers from around the world come to wheel and deal. But if you ask about trade with the U.S., it's grim. Monica Liang is a sales manager at a company that makes juicers and blenders. She says everyone is in wait-and-see mode. Customers from the U.S. have halted orders, she says, and products are piling up in warehouses. Some here expressed optimism that China and the U.S. would strike a deal and avert disaster. But until then, few seem to be selling goods across the Pacific. And many say they're looking for new markets altogether. John Ruich, NPR News, Guangzhou, China.
Wall Street is closed today in observance of Good Friday. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Since the Trump administration took office, it has cut billions of dollars in global health programs. That's everything from vaccines to food assistance to treat malnutrition. Throughout all this, the administration has said that life-saving medications for people with HIV would, however, continue to flow. But on the ground, we're hearing a very different story. NPR's Gabriela Emanuel joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Gabriela, you've just returned from Zambia to find out more about what's going on. Why'd you choose Zambia?
So I chose Zambia because, like many countries in Africa, it was very hard hit by the HIV/AIDS epidemic, which peaked in the mid-90s. And the U.S. has played a pivotal role in controlling the epidemic, including paying for HIV medication. This has been a bipartisan 20-plus year effort, and it's been very effective. New infections have dropped by almost 40% in the last 15 years. Life expectancy has rebounded. So I wanted to see if those HIV drugs are, as the administration says, still accessible.
And are they still accessible?
Well, a lot of people can no longer get their HIV meds, and now they're getting sick. For example, I went to one neighborhood in Zambia's Copper Belt.
Just on the edge of town, there's a U.S.-funded HIV clinic next to a church. And the clinic, it's totally locked up.
Now it's closed.
Reverend Billions Chandwe tells me that it was abruptly shut down in January when the U.S. issued a stop work order. He lets me peek in.
Did they take out the furniture? And they cut the electricity?
Yes.
Okay.
A few months ago, this clinic served thousands of HIV patients. Across the country, there are dozens and dozens of clinics like this one, U.S.-funded, now closed. I walk into the neighborhood and meet many of the clinic's former patients. One is 42-year-old Mary Mayongana. Mary is tall but incredibly skinny. And when I first meet her, she's at home, sitting on the cement floor, her head resting against the brick wall. In the 2.5 months since the clinic shut, she hasn't been able to find a steady supply of her daily HIV meds.
So there are times when I'll go 2 weeks without taking my medication.
Sometimes neighbors give her a few HIV pills. Mary tries to stretch the supply.
So I'll skip 2 days and then take a tablet, skip 2 days and take a tablet.
It's a risky approach since it breeds drug-resistant HIV, but Mary says it's all she can think to do. Without her meds, she's developed classic signs of the virus coming back: weakness, fatigue, fevers, sweats, and a terrible itchy rash.
My skin, my arms is peeling. I've got open wounds. I've got an open wound on my leg.
She's heard there are still HIV drugs at Zambian government clinics, but the closest one is a 45-minute walk, and Mary struggles to even stand.
I spend a lot of time thinking about what is likely to become of me.
Mary is far from alone. Oswald Sindaza oversees a free HIV clinic. He used to have a staff of 21, but after the U.S. cut foreign aid, they were all laid off.
We have over 6,400 clients, and I'm just alone.
6,000 patients for one doctor?
Yes.
And these are all HIV-positive patients?
These are HIV-positive clients. So the clinics are really overwhelmed. I'm moving like a headless chicken.
He says he knows a lot of HIV patients are without their meds, and the virus is rebounding.
Wow, Gabriela, I mean, I'm listening to that, and clearly these life-saving medications are not getting to where they need to be. And the Trump administration is saying they continue. So where's the disconnect here?
So the HIV meds are part of this broader system, a complex supply chain and distribution method. And when the U.S. started pulling contracts and shutting down funding, that whole system just collapsed in a lot of places. And I should note, the U.S. State Department did not respond to my request for comment.
So then who fills the gap here? Does it now fall to the country's Ministry of Health?
Yes, in many cases it does. And I reached out to the Zambian Ministry of Health and they declined to discuss the U.S. aid cuts with me. But in the country, there is this recognition that they were too dependent on aid. Yet at the same time, there is also a lot of outrage that this shutdown happened with absolutely no warning.
NPR's Gabriela Emanuel. Thank you, Gabriela.
Thank you.
The Trump administration is shutting down an offshore wind project that was under construction near Long Island. The multi-billion dollar project would have supplied more than 500,000 homes with power. Here's NPR's Julia Simon.
The project is called Empire Wind 1, and this week, Interior Secretary Doug Burgum sent a memo calling for a halt to the project. Yesterday, Equinor, which operates the project, announced it's suspending all construction. Donald Trump is a longtime critic of wind energy. One of his first actions back in the White House was to issue a moratorium halting new offshore wind projects. But this action, halting a project that already had permits and already broke ground, is an escalation, says Robert Freudenberg at the New York Energy Nonprofit Regional Plan Association.
Yeah, I'd say this really is next level offshore wind aggression.
In his memo to the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, or BOEM, Burgum wrote that the project's approval was, quote, rushed through by the Biden administration. But there's no evidence to suggest it was rushed, says Matthew Eisenson at Columbia University.
BOEM spent 2.5 years conducting an environmental review. The final product of that environmental review is over 3,000 pages long, and it's very thorough. You know, this rationale is very suspect.
The Department of Interior did not respond to NPR's request for comment. Trump has often said, without evidence, that the offshore wind industry kills whales. On Monday, the Government Accountability Office issued a report investigating offshore wind. It finds that the offshore wind industry poses little risk to whales. About 10% of U.S. energy comes from wind. That number was slated to grow with new offshore wind projects in states like Massachusetts and Virginia. But Freudenberg says those projects could be at risk, as are other projects that already have federal permitting.
It should send alarm bells, not just to the offshore wind industry, but to industries beyond offshore wind, that the federal government could choose to stop projects that had been approved and are underway at their whim.
He says now any industry that requires federal permits should wonder, will the U.S. federal government be true to its word? Julia Simon, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Director Joe Wright joins us to talk about the 20th anniversary of his film adaptation of the Jane Austen classic, Pride and Prejudice, next time on Here and Now.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Good morning, Amy Martinez. You might think you've watched Star Wars, but unless you were in the theaters in the 1970s, you probably haven't seen the real original. You know, the one where Han beat Greedo to the punch. George Lucas released updated editions for decades and blocked screenings of that first release, but that version is getting screened for the first time since 1978 at a British film festival in June, before the print goes back into carbonite. Cold storage. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. This weekend, wrestling fans will be watching for the dark side of John Cena. Sure, he's played a good guy in the ring for more than two decades. However, now in what he says is his final year in competition, he has turned bad.
Come on, enough already. Somebody stop this. John, what are you doing?
Yeah, John, what are you doing? Now, that was last month at WWE's Elimination Chamber, where Cena took part in a beatdown of world champion Cody Rhodes. On Sunday, they meet again, with Cena challenging Rhodes for the title at WrestleMania in Las Vegas. And that is where we find David Shoemaker, author and co-host of the Ringer's wrestling podcast, The Masked Man Show. So, David, I mean, the wrestling world has a word for this, the heel turn. So how big of a deal was it when John Cena did it?
It was a really big deal. One, because John Cena, like you said, hadn't been a heel for the 20 years of his fame. He's just been known as the most consistent babyface, as they say in the business. It was also a big deal from a fan's perspective because we've been begging for him to turn heel for most of those 20 years. You know, we're used to seeing our wrestlers go back and forth on the spectrum. And John Cena had just been a stalwart, refusing to embrace the dark side for this whole time.
Now, on WWE Raw last month, Cena sounded like he kind of enjoys playing the bad guy. So let's take a listen to that.
I am going to ruin wrestling for every fan, for every wrestler, for everyone.
Why would he want to go out like this? I mean, is this something that fans actually like? I mean, you said you've been clamoring for it, but does everyone else feel that way?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I talk to wrestlers all the time. Most of them prefer playing heel, right? I mean, it's more fun. You get to just ham it up out there for the fans. Also, you know, they all know that boos are just as good as cheers in their line of work. Will he go out as a heel? This is his final year. My guess is that his last month will probably be as a fan favorite because you can always go home again. But for right now, he's getting to do the thing that he's always wanted to do, too. I mean, it's not just the fans. He's talked openly about wanting this opportunity, wanting to play the bad guy. And I think you can tell from his monologues in the ring, he's really enjoying it.
Now, last month, there was another star of the big screen in the ring coaxing Cena to go over to the dark side, and that was The Rock. So, I mean, what does it mean that these two mega movie stars are playing wrestling villains? I mean, is he following The Rock's footsteps here?
He is in a lot of ways. I mean, The Rock came back last year and teased a WrestleMania main event match, and he was a hero, and he thought everybody would get behind him. But after he took the spot from Cody Rhodes, the fans turned and said, no, we don't want that. We want Cody. He's the guy that we've been following all this time. And The Rock played it on the fly and turned heel. And it turned out to be the best move he could make. I think there was a lot of conventional wisdom that a Hollywood star the level of The Rock couldn't play a heel because it would jeopardize his mainstream appeal. It would make those rope line interviews awkward or whatever. But it turned out to be the best business decision he could have made. He's more famous now and than he possibly could have been, and everybody just took it in stride. And I think you're seeing the same thing with John Cena.
Do you think he's really going to retire?
Well, pro wrestlers are really bad at retiring, famously, just like boxers, you know? I mean, you usually retire at the end of a match when everybody's watching you because you want that moment in the sun, right? And then 2 months later, you're sitting at home and you don't have anything to do and you change your mind. But of all the wrestlers that have ever said they're going to retire, John Cena is one that I believe. He's a man of, it seems to be, of real conviction outside of the ring and would not be doing this without having really thought it through.
David Shoemaker, he hosts the wrestling podcast, The Masked Man Show. He's also author of The Squared Circle, Life, Death, and Professional Wrestling. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Your time is up, my time is now. You can't see me, my time is now.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. Every president brings a personal touch to the Oval Office. Ronald Reagan brought a collection of bronze saddles and his jar of Jelly Bellies. Barack Obama introduced a bust of Martin Luther King Jr. and a bowl of apples. Donald Trump, in his second term, is bringing gold, a lot of it. So how is that changing the look and feel of the White House and the image the presidency projects? Our colleague Michelle Martin posed that question to Robin Givhan. She's a senior critic at large at The Washington Post who recently wrote about what she calls the gilding of the Oval Office.
Well, I think one of the things that most people who've seen pictures of the Oval Office might recall is that over the fireplace mantle, there has long been this large planter filled with ivy. And, you know, the story of that ivy goes back many, many, many presidencies. And that ivy has now been replaced by a series of gold objects. And the pieces that are actually on the mantle are typically used for displaying large floral arrangements, for holding desserts and tea cakes and bonbons. So they're not necessarily things that you would naturally see in an office. And they have been part of the White House collection for years.
So I take it you're not a fan.
I would say that it looks a bit cluttered. And when these pieces were first acquired by the White House, there was some concern in Congress that they reflected too much of an appreciation and an ode to the monarchy, which was not at all what the United States was about. And they also reflect an idea about wealth and power and privilege that feels very of a piece with a different time.
You know, this is always a thing, like, what is taste, right? And a lot of people would sort of say, well, taste is sort of ascribing something to being tasteful or not tasteful is inherently classist. What would you say to that?
I think that's very true. And I think that to some degree, there is an elitist point of view that would look at that, the way that he's decorated the Oval Office, and say that it looks very nouveau riche. And then there are those who could also look at it and say that it's, you know, simply an exuberant celebration of success. But I think one thing that is unnerving is so much of it seems to be situated around this idea of regalness. That is a real departure from the kind of power that the Oval Office has always projected. Part of its power, I think, has come from the fact that it didn't need all of these elements in order to convey authority, that the authority came from this idea of the people and of democracy.
Robin Givhan is Washington Post senior critic at large. Robin, thank you.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
For Easter, churches in Appalachia sell handmade chocolate eggs as fundraisers. Some churches have become famous for the treats. Reporter Zach Harrell takes us into one of their kitchens.
When Pastor John Langenstein found out 4 years ago he'd been assigned to a new church in Clarksburg, West Virginia, everyone he talked to had the same response.
Oh, you're going to the egg church. Didn't matter who I was talking to. Oh, you're going to the egg church. And I said, okay, well, that'll be interesting. And then, oh, you're not ready.
And he wasn't ready for the major chocolate egg operation at Northview United Methodist Church. Every spring, church members gather in the basement kitchen to crank out shiny chocolate eggs.
The molds are double-coated. Yep, and ready to go. We'll put filling in them. And we're doing maple nut this morning.
Serena Ashcraft is in charge today. I asked her how many eggs they usually make for Easter.
Oh my gosh, Nadine, how many do we make?
Oh, between 6,000 and 8,000.
Yeah.
That's Nadine Holt with her in the kitchen. She's in charge of mixing the fillings for those 6,000 to 8,000 eggs.
She's 84 years old.
87!
Oh my gosh, that even makes it more awesome.
Holt has been volunteering since the very first egg sale at Northview in 1997.
The people are dead now that I started with, and they just said, we're going to do Easter eggs. They need you want to help? And I says, sure, here I am.
Northview's eggs come in six flavors: coconut, cherry nut, maple nut, peanut butter, butterfinger, and solid chocolate.
These are the same recipes we've been using for 26 years.
Pastor Langenstein says they make eggs 3 days a week starting in January, all with volunteer labor from the congregation of about 100 people. They spread melted chocolate into molds, add the filling, and box up the finished eggs for sale.
All generations coming in. Last year, our youngest person helping out with eggs was 6 years old, and our oldest was, I think you win that, Nadine, 87. But.
Northview eggs sell for $3 to $9 a piece, depending on the size. They're a big fundraiser for the church and an Eastertime delicacy in these parts. They rarely give them away. Even broken eggs sell for half price. But in the name of journalism, they let me have a taste.
Here's a Butterfinger. It tastes like a Butterfinger.
I told you.
It's peanut butter and candy corn.
Yeah.
The origin of the church-made chocolate Easter egg is kind of hazy. They appear to have first shown up in the mid-20th century in central Pennsylvania before spreading through the rest of central Appalachia. There are other churches all through West Virginia that make and sell chocolate Easter eggs, but Northview is the best known.
To my knowledge, we are the biggest. If there is a bigger, they're not advertising as well as we are.
They sell their eggs around town at beauty parlors, car dealerships, tire shops, and even the courthouse. They also ship them across the country. But for volunteers, it's less about the money.
Other than the fact that, you know, obviously it helps support the work of the church. Is it just fun? For as much work as it is and as much as a taskmaster Serena can be, we get, you know.
We laugh, we joke.
For this small congregation, community and fellowship is worth the long days on the Easter egg production line. For NPR News, I'm Zach Harold in Clarksburg, West Virginia.
You can learn more about how the Northview Easter eggs are made on the podcast, The Daily Yonder. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Layla Faulding.